This is WABF, and it's time now for the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review with Dr. Lou Campomenosi, president of the Common Sense Campaign and adjunct professor of political science at Spring Hill College. This is a paid-for program by Spriggs Enterprises, featuring the Shell gas stations in Daphne on Highways 90 and 98 and in Malbus on 181. And welcome back, Dr. Lou. Good morning.
Well, good morning to you. And here we are, a touch of spring, right?
Okay. Yes.
Nice little bit of weather, even if it's foggy. But, you know, usually with spring comes this uplifting spirit and all like that, all those good things. Well, unfortunately, Dr. Lou is here to give you bad news, okay? If you look at what is going on in Washington, D.C., there ain't much to be uplifted about, okay? So let's just be clear about this. And it's sad to say it, but here we have an administration which is totally undermining the Constitution with its legislation, totally destroying aspects of the economic powerhouse that they inherited despite the pandemic, with doing things like getting rid of Keystone Pipeline and undermining our ability to be the world's number one energy producer. And I could give you a couple of more things which I want to talk about, okay? But I also think that what Biden is doing in the realm of how we see ourselves as Americans is another one of these areas which has potential for an extreme amount of essentially leading to violence, okay? You've seen this in terms of Antifa and the BLM movement using violent means to gain their ends. Now, just this last weekend in Portland, once again, we had another major riot. About 150 of these people from Antifa going down Portland, doing whatever they want to do. Now, at what point do the people in Portland rise up and say, enough is enough? Their mayor a couple of weeks ago said something along those lines, but this guy does nothing to protect the business interests, the people, all those things that government is supposed to be doing. So, Lori, I have a real question here. At what point does this kind of behavior that's being tolerated by the Democrat Party and, I would argue, those gas being thrown on the BLM movement by all of the stuff they see in the national media that talking about white supremacy, white privilege, all the rest of these kinds of things, really is setting a match to an issue that, to a very large degree, one could argue, and I've said this many, many times here, this issue of the civil rights movement being, moving in the right direction over a reform period that brought us to the point where there was a degree of racial harmony, there's a degree of racial tolerance. And I've suggested that when you look at some of the data, interracial marriages, 250,000 in 1970, over 5 million today, the degree to which you have a political and social revolution in terms of black participation at all levels of government. Now, how is it that we are now told that everything is really bad, it's the world is upside down, because nothing is right and everything is wrong, and that we've got to make reparations, we've got to cancel culture of those people like me saying things like I'm saying right now, that this whole argument by the BLM people is nothing more than a Marxist attempt to sow the seeds of revolution, because that's what they want to do. Now, think about this for a second. Run the reel back to 1963, where the arch segregationists in Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, they all were in charge, okay? At that time, one could legitimately argue that perhaps armed insurrection against the system might have been justified. I think you could make that case. And the Black Panthers tried to make that case. But guess what? There was a countervailing argument made by Dr. Martin Luther King. And his basic argument was, we can gain more through civil disobedience and calling upon, you know, the Constitution and the Declaration and the consciences of the American people to do what is right and just. Now, you and I are both old enough, although you're not as old as I am, I got that, to remember some of these things. And certainly, in remembering them, well, let's put it this way. How are we supposed to remember it? Are we supposed to remember what took place in the Civil Rights Movement as something that we can look back on proudly and say, we did change, we did reform? Or are we going to look back and say, well, the contemporary critics are saying that it wasn't enough? And I'm just wondering about that. And then I had an experience last week. I went into town to talk to one of our potential chapter leaders. We're going to start another chapter back again in Mid-Mobile. So we went to the IHOP on Airport Boulevard, and I explained this to him too after we were leaving. I was just surprised to see lots of blacks and whites together at this IHOP. And the black encounters that I had were all friendly, all, you know, nice. I asked an easy question about how do we get our names on the list of, you know, getting a seat. And this young lady was really very nice answering. I mean, she didn't act like I was, you know, imposing on her simply because I was asking a dumb question, which could have been easy enough. She didn't have to answer it nicely, but she did. Other people were there, were friendly. Now, what do we deduce from this encounter? It seems to me that the national media stirring up the pot hasn't really translated into changes in behavior and people being nice to each other down here in Mobile or in Baldwin County. Now, again, I'm not going to carry this too far, but I'm just suggesting to you that if the whole BLM movement is to make trouble, which it is, that has not really, well, let's put it this way. It's a narrow segment of opinion. I got that. But still, is it the general feeling today when you go out to a store, Lori, or I go to a store, go to Winn-Dixie Place, do we see sullen, angry blacks? Or do we see just regular citizens going about their business, you know? And I think that the latter is the case. So once again, we get back to fundamentals. How is it that these people at BLM are able to steal the historical record, which basically starts long before Martin Luther King, with the NAACP and its Legal Defense Fund attacking segregation in the 30s, the 40s, leading to the Brown decision in 1954. Now, the last time I looked, 1954 is a long-ass time ago, right? It is not yesterday. So the movement, and again, think about this. The first legal case that the civil rights people were really, you know, ready to fight for and actually won was the Gaines case over segregation in schools, in the higher level schools, okay? 1935, they won the case. And there were after these other cases that were made. So my point here is that when you look at the legal attempts to get rid of segregation, and then you look at Eleanor Roosevelt's role in awakening the American conscience to the plight of, you know, its minorities, throughout the 1930s when she had writing her column about it. And if you look at what FDR did during the war to make sure that the Fair Employment Practices Act was passed to eliminate discrimination in wartime job industries. Those are the kinds of things that kind of take you down this direction of, well, how does BLM get to rewrite history, and why are we supposed to be you know, guilty about parts of our history that certainly were not good, but the reality is people were doing the right thing to try to change that system. The interesting part of it is that if you look at the war against Nazi racism, the argument is pretty quick. You know, oh my God, look at some of the things the Nazis were doing against, you know, their own people, the Jews, the racial, you know, arguments they were making about the, you know, the super race. It's, we're holding a mirror up to our own country to a very large degree. Some of those kinds of racial attitudes were here. And people started to realize that. Then you had, you know, young blacks being, you know, drafted into the army, some of whom were officers, the Tuskegee pilots. Those folks came out of the war believing in themselves, believing that it was wrong to see what was going on here in the United States, and they're fighting for freedom overseas when freedom does not exist back home. So what I'm suggesting to you here is that the experiences of the past led this country to a position where by the early 60s, it was time to change the system. The system adapted, the system changed through the 64-65 Civil Rights Act. Okay? Now, having said all of these kinds of things, it seems to me that where you're going with this is that the contemporary attempt to say to us that it's all about white supremacy, it's all about white privilege, belies the fact that whites took an active role in trying to change this system. And it manifests itself most prominently with the 64 and 65 Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act. And again, as I suggested to you, we have the social and political revolution that's a part of the 64-65 revolution. So I'm not going to sit here and feel guilty about all this crap. They can say anything they want. It doesn't stand up to any kind of analysis, and it shouldn't make us feel that we did something wrong simply because of the color of our skin, particularly when whites worked with blacks throughout the civil rights era to try to change the system in a better way. So here we have Mr. Biden trying to destroy all of this in terms of his movement towards not suppressing Antifa and BLM, who are misusing the freedoms they have to create riots and violence in terms of getting their ends. It's something that I think that we have got to make sure that people understand and are willing to say no to, because if we allow this to happen, then what is definitely going to happen is militias are going to start forming up. And once we go down that road of having our militia against their militia, then it's over. And I think that the degree to which the federal government has got to be able to suppress Antifa in Portland is a critical, critical statement. So we'll see where they go with that.
What makes you think they would start that now?
The only thing that I think that gives them hope, that gives me any hope about this, is that sooner or later, people like Joe Manchin on the Democrat side are going to see what's going on and say no to it. You had a couple of Democrats vote against H.R. 1, which is some of the things I want to talk about today. So two Democrats vote against H.R. 1. All the Republicans voted against it. So there is a political dynamic which is still available if we have enough people of conscience like Manchin and Sinema from Arizona, Sinema rather. So I do think that it's still a possibility. But the question that has been asked is, well, what's the trigger point if Congress can't stop some of these things from going on? So here again, we get back to my point earlier about let's talk about some of the things that Biden is doing. Domestically, they are not allowing law and order to flourish, and that is that's a crime, okay? What's interesting, and I don't think I said this last week, in Los Angeles, the L.A. district attorney was sued by prosecutors in his own office because he was not enforcing the three strikes and you're out law that California passed back in the 90s. Duh. Okay. Prosecutors suing and winning in court. Okay. So here again, this is the hopeful sign that there are some people who are going to wake up to this, who are not necessarily living in red states like Alabama. And if that's the case, then there is hope that these trigger points are points that are not necessarily going to take us down some sort of a civil war path. But let's be honest with you, okay? If Biden can't do something about the border, and he certainly doesn't seem to be, because, you know, we've got issues concerning not only H.R. 1, but this United States USACA 2021 Act, which is an act that is going to just completely open up the border. It undermines the legal authority already in existence in terms of who is a, you know, how we get to legal status. These kinds of things are issues that have to be dealt with. And I would argue here that when you take H.R. 1, which essentially takes over at the federal level all elections, well, just how are we supposed to let this happen when in the Constitution we know that the states have control over how elections are done? And this is what is so discouraging about the Supreme Court decision last week. I mean, the fact that they would not stand up and say that what took place in Pennsylvania, where the Secretary of State, the governor, and the state Supreme Court essentially changed the Pennsylvania election laws, all because of the pandemic. I got that. That was the excuse. Okay. But whatever one feels about using the pandemic as an excuse does not justify willy-nilly changing the Pennsylvania law about elections. Neither does it justify what happened in Georgia. And I've mentioned these things before, so I'm not going to get into it again. But the argument here is, if we are going to have the rule of law, and if things like have to stop along the lines of what we saw in Pennsylvania and in Georgia, then what happens if it doesn't happen? What happens if the Supreme Court keeps on passing up its opportunities to say, this has got to end? Now, I'm hopeful that part of the reason they may have passed this up was because it was tied to the Trump business, and there's no remedy for what happened in the election. But not being a constitutional lawyer, I can only hope that somewhere along the line a case is going to come up that will be crystal clear in how, and to be honest with you, I just don't understand how Pennsylvania could not be that case again. We'll see how this goes. But the point is that if the Supreme Court is not going to rule to protect the Constitution from the attacks that the Democrats, you know, laid on it in the run-up to the 2020 election, it's pretty clear that it's over, because the Democrats will have been able to leverage their power to the point where no political party will be able to challenge it. And if John Roberts' concerns about what is going on in the streets of these various cities and the rioting that could ensue if the Supreme Court dared to challenge what the Democrats did in Pennsylvania and in Georgia and the other states, if that's what's concerning John Roberts, then it is over. So you better start thinking about what you're going to do with all this, because, you know, that's clearly one of the things that, you know, government is supposed to be able to protect us from. Well, will our state also protect us from the vagaries of, you know, power unleashed by these unconstitutional means? I mean, it's something to kind of think about. So, and I want to talk about some of the state things that are going on in just a second, okay? But questions about the COVID-19 plan. Here again, 9% of this bill, $1.9 trillion, 9% going for COVID relief. The rest of it, yeah, Lori's looking at me surprised. Yes, yes, yes. I wish I wasn't right about that, but that's all this is. This is a boondoggle. It's absurd. And I mean, I think I mentioned last week, Larry Summers, economics czar for Obama, basically said, you're dealing with major inflation if you go down this road. Well, we'll see how that works out. But clearly, you know, this is just another example of, you know, power being misused. We'll see if when this gets to the Senate, whether Manchin and Sinema will stand up and say no to it. I wouldn't hold my breath on that one, but you just never know. Manchin seems to be, you know, the kind of rebel, sometimes without a cause, but in this case, he does have a cause. So we'll see how this goes.